Well, I thank you for singing that song with such enthusiasm. And it is my hope and prayer, and it's been my prayer all week long, that by the time we finish this series of lessons, you will be more enthusiastic about that song and your confidence in the great God who made us than you are tonight. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to be with us this evening. I do want to make a little advertisement. This is a series of three lessons, which means there's a lot more to talk about tomorrow night and, God willing, Sunday evening on this general theme. Hope you can be part of all of it. If you can't, we are live streaming, and hopefully you'll take the time to look at it further. In addition to that, there's published on the back a bibliography. I'm going to be referring to a number of books in the course of this series, and you don't have to write them all down because they're in the bibliography, and the best ones have stars by them. And I hope if you're very interested in this topic, you will take advantage of following up with those references. Well, again, thank you for being here. And rather than take any more time with pleasantries, just understand it's a great pleasure and a privilege to represent the God of heaven as we talk tonight. Thank you for being here. So, can Christianity and science coincide? I can tell you there are lots of folks today who would say absolutely not. We live in an age in which faith and religion have come to be in conflict. I want to do tonight a little bit of background to lead us up to where we are today, to explain why it is we are where we are, and also to illustrate to you that Christianity and science for a long time were in perfect agreement and still are if you understand them properly. So let's talk. The book on which Christianity is founded, the Bible, has the following to say in the Old Testament in Psalms chapter 19. If you have your Bible with you, you can turn with me. If not, just listen carefully. Psalm 19, verse 1 through 4 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language, their voice is not heard, their line is gone throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." The psalmist clearly declares that the universe declares the existence of God. In our text, the Bible. In the New Testament, there's a very incredible passage that fits perfectly with our theme this week. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, I read it to you as we begin, and we'll refer to it in every lesson because it fits. "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools." So the New Testament also teaches that you can see God in nature. You can certainly learn of his eternal power and his divinity. In other words, observation of nature reveals God, according to the Bible. And that argument is made several times in Scripture, and I'm going to refer to it in this series as the argument from design. Always and forever, the strongest argument from nature for the existence of God. So that will be the foundation of what we talk about. We're going to talk about the argument from design. Well, modern science as we know it today was not always around. In fact, most historians of science would credit the Age of Enlightenment, the Renaissance, as the time when modern science really developed. And what you need to understand is, in those days, many, if not most, of the scientists in the 16 to 1800s were strong believers in God, in Jesus Christ, and in the Bible, and openly express such on a regular basis. So I thought I'd share with you a few of those this evening. We could go on and on about that, and I'd highly recommend to you a book called Science and Christianity, Conflict or Coherence, written by Dr. Henry Schaefer, a physical chemist of our day who's one of the foremost of those, taught at many of our universities, and an outspoken proponent, believer in God. And in this text, he shows how scientists throughout the ages have been strong proponents of both the Bible and the evidence from the scientific processes. So here's a famous scientist from the 15 and 1600s named Johannes Kepler. If you're not familiar with him, he's one of the foremost astronomers and respected deeply for his progress that he made in his understanding of the universe by very hard labor. Here's one quote from Johannes Kepler. "I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are the priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful not of the glory of our minds, but rather above all else of the glory of God." Don't you love that? In our time, many of our scientists are glorifying themselves. These men, when science was being invented, glorified God. And we thank God for that. "Studies in the world using science are acceptable to me," Kepler said, "and to Christians, since our faith holds that the world was created by God in weight, measure, and number." He's a man of my own heart. "That in accordance with those ideas that are co-eternal with him in his book, The Harmony of the World." So Johannes Kepler had a profound respect for the Creator as he learned more and more about his creation. And probably the most famous scientist in our time, Isaac Newton, probably everybody in this audience knows that name, lived from 1642 to 1727, and close to my heart, the co-inventor of calculus, only the most important class there is. I'm looking at a bunch of people in this audience that had my class, and I know you've never forgotten it. And we also were thinking God's thoughts after him, because in calculus, you're studying the concept of infinity, and you never get closer to God than that. And we came to where we could describe it mathematically. And may I get off on a tangent here for just a moment? There is no greater understanding that humans will ever have of the natural world than when you can describe it mathematically. And calculus allows that in a host of fields. That's why it's the most important subject you'll ever take in terms of human learning. Isaac Newton was probably one of the greatest mathematicians that ever lived. And he made this comment in his General Scholium to the Principia, his most important work. "Though these bodies may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity," and I interrupt the quote to remind you that he is the one who first described the law of gravity mathematically. And it has been a blessing ever since. "Yet they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of the orbits themselves from these laws. Thus this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful Being, capital B. I love that. He also wrote a number of texts on his studies of the Bible. So in the early 1800s, a gentleman by the name of William Paley wrote a book on natural theology, which became the standard subject to be given in a university in the early 1800s. And if you went to college in England or in Europe during those days, you would very likely have taken a course in natural theology by William Paley. And so his book, On the Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity, Collected from the Appearances of Nature, was the standard work. And it began with a very famous story about a watch. You may have heard that. I'm not going to take time tonight to tell you that whole story. But the idea is, if I was walking across a heath in England and I came across a watch lying there, it is highly unlikely that I would think, well, isn't it interesting how nature produced that watch? Rather, I would start looking for whose watch it was and who made it. Whereupon he proceeds to make arguments about the natural world that is much more complex than a watch. And therefore it too speaks of a maker. And he builds his case around that general theme. Well, I can tell you that in our time, that whole notion of the argument from design has become anathema to many people. So how is it by the end of the 20th century, some 200 years later, we now have a culture in which scientific materialism rules the world of science across this country and around the world? How did we get to such a place? And if I may be a little bit personal about this, I began college in 1963. In the midst of many of the things I'm going to be telling you about tonight, tomorrow night, Sunday night. I lived through it, young people, in my college career. And so I know very well from a personal basis what was happening and how it was being presented. Richard Dawkins, born in 41 and still lives today, British evolutionary biologist and author, professor of public understanding of science at Oxford, appointed to that position, by the way, by a special donation, now presents himself as representing science to the world and helping teach the common man, like you and I, about science. And it is that gentleman who states things like this in his book, The Selfish Gene, in 1976, faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence, a process of non-thinking. Thank you very much. So you want to accuse Newton of non-thinking and a host of others who are considerably smarter than you are, sir. But Mr. Dawkins must have had some kind of horrible experience with religion in his earlier years, because he later wrote a book called The God Delusion in 2006, in which he makes this statement: if this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. And among other things he says in that book, God is a delusion, a psychotic delinquent invented by mad, deluded people. And I would say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that in a common discussion of science and religion, that's not a very helpful statement. It's highly prejudicial, and of course it's completely wrong. But he somehow feels free in this modern day as a representative of science to talk like that. I take great offense. And I have personally lived some of it in my college days and early life as a believer who was also a scientist. Carl Sagan was a professor at Harvard in the 1960s when I was a student there. I didn't have him in class, but I certainly knew of him. He later moved to Cornell and was there 30 years and was highly influential. He set up the most watched science program in the history of mankind. It was called the Cosmos series. And the beginning line in that series was this: the cosmos is all that is, or that was, or that ever will be. Now, may I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that is not in any sense a scientific statement. And for it to be used as the opening of a science series is almost blasphemy. It's philosophical at best. And it is certainly not anything you could demonstrate from science. But it illustrates where we are in the 20 and 21st centuries and where science has gone since the 1600s and 1700s, when those brilliant men of old saw they were looking at God's thoughts after him. Now the common perception is that if you do proclaim faith, you've just stepped out of science and we don't want to hear anything from you. I'm going to refer a little later this evening to a gentleman named Dr. James Tour, who's a professor of nanoengineering at Rice University at the present time. He's a world-renowned scholar in nanoengineering. He's amazing. He said, the discriminations against people of faith within the scientific community is an ongoing issue. I'm talking to you about somebody that's in the business right now. They make it so hard for people to speak up. You take a young assistant professor who's going to speak to us and boldly tell about his or her faith. And then you threaten that person. And that if you don't follow the party line, you're not going to get into the societies. You will not be recognized. You will not get published. I mean, it's a frightening thing. You wanted conformity? Okay, you got it. And he says, this is part of why I'm here at Rice University, because I want to help shut the mouths of those who are belittling Christians. But it is a reality. And if you're not aware, beloved, that college universities today are full of professors who think they know more than God knows, and who are more than ready to belittle the faith of those who are willing to speak about it. And that's why I do this series. So I'm telling you, young people in this audience, you don't need to be afraid of science. Because if you study deeply and you keep your mind open and don't let it be poisoned by those who will not see, you can build a deeper faith than you ever imagined. At your ages, I was concerned that if I studied science too deeply, I'd lose my faith in God. Here I am 50 years later with a stronger faith than ever, and it's founded partly upon the phenomenal evidence that God exists. And don't listen to professors who would get off of their topic and belittle you because you're a Christian. So can Christianity and science agree? Depends on who you're talking to. There is conflict between science and Christianity in our time, and I'd like to give you a little brief summary about how we got there. So this will be the fastest history of science treatment ever. And let me tell you that one of the great privileges of my life at Harvard, besides being married to Marilyn, which I would never have thought about going there if I hadn't been already married and had a little bit of my feet on the ground. Don't go to Harvard right out of high school, kids. That is no place for you. They will chew you up and eat you up and spit you out. You wait till you have a little bit of sense. But I was privileged to sit at the feet of the foremost historians of science and biology and in chemistry and mathematics. And what you do in those classes, you go back and read original sources. So you're sitting at the feet of those brilliant people from the past and learning how they thought. And those men from the ancient past back in the 1617 and 1800s are worth reading. But there came along a whole host of others who took it a whole different direction. So men like Pierre Simon de Laplace, who thought he was as wise and the next Newton, he was not, but he thought so. And he looked at the same natural world evidences that Newton did and made this statement: nature with its matter, energy, and forces could produce and maintain our solar system. No need for a God hypothesis. And a lot of people bought it. In the area of geology, Charles Lyell wrote his famous book, Principles of Geology, which was an attempt to explain the former changes in the Earth's surface by references to causes now in operation. The present is the key to the past, he said, and any formation you can study in geology, you don't need God for that. Nature can explain it. And he highly influenced Darwin because he talked about massive ages given long enough time for natural causes to bring about everything you observe. And, of course, Charles Darwin in 1859 published his infamous book, The Origin of Species, or it means as the means of set in by natural selection for the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. And, of course, the whole thesis of the origin of species was there's no need for a designer to account for the origin of the species of life. Natural selection acting on natural variation accounts for the appearance of design. It's sufficient, ladies and gentlemen. And I can tell you that in our day, there's come to be almost a worship of natural selection acting on natural variation. It can do what God can do in the minds of many. Darwin has, according to Dawkins and many others, allowed me to be a respectable, Dawkins said, atheist. And I say, God forbid. And then Alexander O'Perrin and J.B.S. Haldane came up with a theory in the early 1900s that not only do you not need God for the origin of species, you don't need God to produce life from non-living matter. They came up with a theory of how things were in the early earth that could have produced life without God. And it came to be widely accepted. That is a touch the tops of the mountains overview. But over 200 years, the scientific community has bought in to the general worldview that the evolutionary theory and natural causes are all you need. The blind forces of physics acted upon by natural selection is sufficient to account for everything you see. I say it's time to revisit the argument from design. And that's what I want to do with you tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday night. And please accept my apology before we ever start for the incomplete, inadequate treatment I will give each subject during these 3 days, because there's so much more that needs to be said. But I hope to touch your minds and your hearts about this general theme. So, are you ready, class? We're ready for a class in science now. I don't allow sleeping. And I've been teaching a long time, so I can see you. And if I can see the audience fading out, then we're going to stop and stand up, and everybody will have a little calisthenics. Because I know how it is. I had supper also. And when you're sitting, I'm going to lose you. I don't allow that. So are you ready? Do something with your head. All right. I want to present to you first 3 amazing texts that are all written by Stephen Meyer. He's one of my favorite authors in science. There aren't very many good science writers, folks. Most of them they're not good writers. Let's just put it that way. The Signature in the Cell is a study of DNA in the cell and what it does and the amazing story it tells. The second one is Darwin's Doubt. And this is a study of the origin of life and the complications that science has with the origin of life. And folks, Dr. Tour, if you ever want to listen to somebody interesting on the origin of life, you listen to him. He is in the study of nano stuff down at the micro level. And origin of life, he says, people who talk about that act like they know something. And he said, all I need is a few minutes with them and show them they don't know anything. Darwin's doubt was that the fossil record does not support the general theory of evolution on how life got started. It does not. There's an explosion of life forms, and one form is called the Cambrian layer, and nobody has an answer for that. It looks more like, boom, there's life. So that's what this book is about. And the third one, which I'm going to appeal to especially tonight, just written recently, is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. As Laplace said those many years ago, I don't need the God hypothesis. Meyer is saying, you better look again. because the evidence has been uncovered in the 20th and 21st centuries, puts a hole in the notion that we don't need God. And it's summarized very well in this text. So if you're going to read only one of the three, start with this one, because it's a summary of what we're going to talk about tonight and over the next three lessons. And I even put a picture of it up here. And it's in the bibliography, of course. What he says in that text is there are three great scientific discoveries, evidences that have become overwhelmingly strong in the last 100 years. That was not the case before that, which is part of why we left God behind. And here they are. First, that the universe, that is space, matter, and time, has a beginning. I like to pause, because what I just said is very important. That is not what folks thought during that 200-year period. They thought the universe is eternal. You don't need anything to explain it, because it's always been here, and it explains how we got here and how we made up God. Now I can tell you that the common conception in the scientific community, who are not all and not many of them not believers in God, is that yes, the universe has a beginning. And many of them will say out loud, I don't like that. Because if you're an atheist and the universe had a beginning, you got a big old problem. Because they say it came only from nature itself. But if nature itself had a beginning, then what did it come from? It's a big problem. I'm not talking about that one of the three in this series, but it's worthy of your study. The Big Bang, they call it now. I'm not going to discuss that with you in this series, but I will tell you, whatever else it does, it speaks to a beginning for matter, space, and time. Sounds like Genesis 1:1 to me. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And our answer to that as theists is that God started this universe with all of its amazing properties. The atheist has no answer if there was a beginning. Secondly, the universe, our solar system, and Earth are remarkably fine-tuned to support life on Earth and has been since the beginning. That, ladies and gentlemen, was also not accepted 100 years ago. That one I want to talk with you about tonight on a limited basis. And the third one is this. Even the simplest forms of life at the biochemical level contain massive amounts of digital information being used to produce and maintain an untold number of molecular machines and complex processes. I lost you, didn't I? Let me put it in simple English. Every little living thing you study is full of a massive amount of information. And in our lifetime and in the history of mankind, information always comes from intelligence. There is zero evidence that information, like we see stored in every living thing, comes from anything but intelligence. That has now been so confirmed in the last 100 years that it is very difficult to get around. And I want to talk to you about that. Because you see, class, that gets you into chemistry at the biochemical level. And that's my passion. So let's talk first about the Goldilocks Enigma, a little book written by Paul Davies in 2008. Paul Davies is an atheist and an evolutionist. He doesn't believe in God. But he does have to admit in this text that one of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are part of it. We humans who are sitting around thinking about where we came from. And I would agree that that's the most significant fact. Second, he says everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life. So why does he call it the Goldilocks enigma? We have to tell the story. Kids, you remember Goldilocks? Well, she ate it all up, right? Because it was just right. That's why he calls this the Goldilocks enigma. Because everywhere you look in nature, things are just right to support life on earth. And you don't have to believe me. I've got all kinds of books that you can go read for yourself. And that is an agreed upon principle, ladies and gentlemen. Even the evolutionists and the atheists don't disagree with that. So if you were in a court of law, that's a case that would already be established, and now we go on to try to explain why. Nobody's arguing with that. So my goal in the next few minutes is to show you some of the reasons that we've come to believe in this fine-tuning. The Goldilocks enigma. When I was in college in the 1960s, they had established some two characteristics of the cosmos and some 8 to 10 of the solar system that they believed were fine-tuned. It was just beginning to be studied. Class, and I'll call you my class because this is a lecture, folks. By the 2000s, scientists had discovered 38 characters of the cosmos and over 150 characteristics of the solar system. All right, I want to paint this picture with you, and you get it. Everybody stick with me. We're having a court case. You're the jury. And I'm one of the lawyers. I'm going to argue with you, and I'm going to try to present to you evidence that the universe is fine-tuned for living things and that had to have been done by some kind of intelligence. That's where I'm going with this. You're going to have to decide for yourself. But I do want you to think about it in terms of being on a jury trying to decide a case. And part of the reason for that is there's another wonderful little book I want to recommend to you. It's called God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. J. Warner Wallace was a detective and an atheist. His daddy was an atheist and still is. J. Warner Wallace wrote this book to try to convert his daddy from atheism because he's now a believer. And he calls it God's Crime Scene. And here's why. He takes every chapter and he builds it around a particular crime that he had to solve. He's a cold case detective. You know what that is? That's a detective that comes in when they couldn't solve the case and tries to solve it later when it's gotten cold. That's the hardest kind of detective work, isn't it? But you can put together the composition of evidences and you can come up with a case. So chapter 2, I'm going to read you just a little bit of the opening of this chapter. This is reading time. You ready? Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old home, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This was not like Carrie at all. She usually left at least one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. The couple had a child named Lexi. But the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie. And just last night, Carrie confided there'd been yet another fight. When Helen could not get Carrie to answer the door, she called the police. I'd love to read you the rest of that story. This whole chapter is built around solving that case. And I'm going to tell you the end of the story. They convicted Todd of first-degree murder of his wife and his daughter, who were found dead in that house. But ladies and gentlemen, nobody saw anybody kill him. There was no direct evidence. It was all indirect. It was a series of circumstantial evidences that all added up. And he and his cohorts convinced a jury. So let me read you another statement from this chapter. We were compelled to examine the evidence of tampering because of one important fact. There were two dead bodies in the crime scene. How'd that happen? And he said, I always approach these things by saying, could we explain it all by staying inside the house? Or did someone from the outside have to tamper with this? In a similar way, he says, we look at the nature of our universe and the existence of living bodies that ought to provoke an investigation. What Paul Davies say? Probably the most important fact is you're here. How do we have all these living human beings here? That's the question. Like our murder scene, he says, there are foundational, regional, and locational conditions demanding explanation. And he proceeds to go through those different types of evidence for nature, for the jury. You with me? So let me just give you a little more about Carrie and Lexi who died. Every crime has a backstory, so there's foundational conditions. Some set of foundational conditions. It was important for us to consider that Carrie and Todd's relationship was terrible, right? Wouldn't you agree, jury? And of course you're going to pound on that. He told her last night, a couple of weeks ago, he's going to kill her. They found out that 2 days before they found them dead, he restarted the gas service to the house, which hadn't been on for a long time. Foundational evidence. All right. With that beginning, class, I want to present you some more foundational evidence about nature. So here we go. The laws of nature, the physical constants and ratios, the properties of the elements and the properties of chemicals. I'm talking about the cosmos now. Folks, there are properties that we've discovered about the cosmos that have to be just right, or we wouldn't be here. Now, it's hard to convince you about that. But any physicist that studied this in depth will tell you it is amazing that all these factors have to be within such a fine tolerance or we would not be here. In other words, they're foundational to the existence of our life. Just like his turning on that gas is foundational to his guilt for the dead people. So I got to give you a little bit of information. The law of gravity that Newton discovered. What we found out is that the law of gravity has to fall within a very narrow range of possibilities, or you wouldn't be here. So he gives that example in his book, and he says, imagine one stretching a measuring tape across the entire known universe. Now imagine one particular mark on the tape represents the correct degree of gravitational force required to create the universe we have. You with me thus far, class? Jury, I can't lose you here. Imagine a tape stretching from one end of the universe to the other, and you're looking at one little mark, which is the proper size of the gravitational force. You with me? If this mark were moved by 1 inch from its location on the measuring tape that stretches from one end of the universe to the other, the altered gravitational force would prevent our universe from coming into existence. Is that a fine area of tolerance, folks? And nobody argues with that fact. You change the gravitational force by just a teeny-nicey little bit, you wouldn't be here. Neither would I. Now, that's just one of hundreds of situations similar. So in this slide, I have the laws of nature, physical constants, the properties of elements. There's another one about the strong nuclear force and the expansion rate of the universe. They have to be within 1 to times 10 to the 37th. I mean, that's an inconceivable change. fine-tuned. There are lots of them on the screen right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, you understand, we could be here for the next 6 weeks telling you more details about those. But believe me, they are all within a very narrow range, and if you changed any of them, you wouldn't be here. Next, let's talk about our galaxy. We live in a galaxy, ladies and gentlemen. Kepler didn't know that, but we do now. And we know what kind of galaxy we live in. And we know there are lots of galaxies. Did you know that was not known until probably the early 1900s? I want to give you a little bit of a taste of how many galaxies there are in our universe. So, Michael, are you guys about ready? Don't do it yet. Wait a minute. I will tell you when. Everybody look up here. If I took a grain of sand in my hand and I held it up here and I looked at that grain of sand and I thought the amount of space out there that that little grain of sand spans is how much we're talking about on the picture I'm going to show you next. Did I lose you? The picture I'm going to show you is a picture of a piece of the universe that's about the size that would be covered by that grain of sand. Okay? Now, turn the lights off, because we're out in the desert. And I got to make sure I see where I am here. All right, you ready? This picture, class, was taken by the new James Webb telescope that's out there that's been mounted. You remember this went up? This was on July the 22nd. They took this picture. You ready? You remember, that's a piece of the universe about the size of a piece of sand if I'm looking at it. And look at what all's in it. You are aware, aren't you, that that's a lot of stuff. You look at that glob, right, you say, isn't that a mighty big star? No, class, that is a galaxy with billions of stars in it. As are all of these that are large globs here. Those are all galaxies. Look at this one. Can you see that one real well? Can you see the spirals in it? That is a spiral galaxy right there, taken in this picture. Okay, why isn't that working? There. That's the galaxy cluster SMACS 0723 by the James Webb Space Telescope, July 12, 2022. I want you to be stunned by the massiveness of this. Okay, lights back on, please. Of all of those galaxies you see in that picture, almost none of them could support life. Are you listening? Most galaxies are elliptical galaxies. The gravitational forces that are present in an elliptical galaxy would not allow a solar system with planets around it like our sun has. Don't believe me. I'm not an astronomer. I'm quoting you from things I've read. The galaxy we live in is a spiral galaxy. And by the way, it's a rather tightly spiraled galaxy. It's a class B. Only about 10% of all the galaxies in the universe are spiral. You didn't see many of those up there. And of the spiral galaxies, not too many of them are type that we're in. In fact, the experts say that only about 1% of all of the galaxies in the universe could support life on a planetary system around a star like we have. So, all that means, class, is we're eliminating 99% of all the galaxies in the universe as a place where you could find life. But that's only the beginning. We're looking at foundational, and now we're going into regional evidences. You have to be at the right place in the galaxy. So if you look at our spiral galaxy on the side, there's a big bulge in the middle. You better not be in there because there'd be no life in there at all. In fact, there's only two places in that galaxy where you could have a solar system like ours. It's out here in this space and over here in this space. And guess where our sun is? Right there. In our galaxy. And class, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, everybody knows this. I'm not telling you something I'm making up. So that eliminates 149 out of 150th of this whole galaxy as a place you're going to find life. Would you say we're restricting things a little bit? But it's not good enough to just be in the right place in the right galaxy. You also have to be the right kind of star. It has to be, say it with me, just right. That's exactly right. So what about our star? Well, the sun is only the perfect star, of course. So here's our sun compared to our planets. Of course, it's humongous, but when you compare our sun to lots of other stars, Sirius and Pollux and Arcturus, it gets to be kind of tiny. And look at this, Betelgeuse and Antares, where's the sun? Right there. You can't even see it. Folks, there are stars way bigger than the sun, and there are stars way smaller than the sun. A whole lot of stars are dwarf stars. The sun is, say it again. Thank you. But it's not just size, it's temperature and variability. And our sun is. Exactly. But is that enough, you think? No, the location of the planet's very important. First of all, you've got to have planets. And you know there's massive searches going on for planets out there in the universe right now. And you'll hear one every now and then, we found another planet. Generally, what they found is one like Jupiter that's so humongous, there's never been any life on Jupiter. So what about our planets? Well, you know, we got Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune and Earth and, say it, Venus is the one closest to our size. And then Mars and then Mercury and then is Pluto in or out? Depends on who you talk to. I say it's in. Amen. We got an amen on that. That's good. By the way, I have another whole lecture I do that involves the New Horizons expedition. Are you familiar with this? Did you know we sent a spaceship to Pluto? Took them 10 years to get there. I'll tell you about that one someday. The fact is, class, Pluto is so cold it's freezing. Around any given star, you have a habitable zone. Out of all our planets, the only three that could work at all would be these three, Earth, Venus, and Mars. Venus is out because of all kinds of reasons. Some of you kids could tell us about Venus because you've been studying it. I heard it in homeschool. Venus has about a large percentage of sulfuric acid in its atmosphere. That's not a good place for life. Plus, it rotates backwards. And it's a stupid planet. Is anybody looking for life on Venus? You tell me. No, they are not. So where are we looking for life? Mars. Because they think there's some possibility there might sometime have been a little tiny, neensy-pinsy-witsy little bit of water. Our Earth is covered with 70% water. There ain't no comparison. Has to be in the right location. Our Earth is in the habitable zone. You think that's enough? No, class. We haven't even gotten started. And believe me, I'm not going through all 178 of them. But would you agree, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that you reach a point where coincidence doesn't hack it? All of this stuff that has to be just within a finely tuned place, you could say, well, isn't it interesting how nature did that? But don't you reach a point of unbelievability? I'm already there. But we're not finished. Let's talk about locational. By the way, when you go back to this book, and he looks at locational evidence, they got inside that house, and first of all, it stunk like gas. Second, he had clothes stuffed under the door of the bedroom. He had opened the vent of the gas thing, which had never been opened in years. I mean, the evidence piled up. Somebody from outside tampered with that house. That's why they're dead. And I'm telling you, when we get through with this lineup of evidence, somebody tampered with this from the outside. This universe did not form itself. Something from the outside tampered with it. So, here's a bunch of locational ones right here on Earth. It has to have the proper mass, the proper spin, the proper tilt, the proper moon. Do you know how important our moon is? Okay, I got an assignment for you. How many moons do we have, class? One. Do you know that's unusual? Anybody in this class know how many moons Pluto has, that little tiny planet? Because that's your assignment. You bring back tomorrow night how many moons Pluto has. All right? Our moon is critically important to this earth and life. There are whole chapters about that. And I'm not talking about it tonight. The properties of biochemicals like DNA and proteins and cells, the genetic code and molecular machines, that's where I'm going next for just a little while tonight. And tomorrow night, we're going to knock it out of the park. So don't you miss. But the cell, class. In Darwin's day, one of the statements made about the cell was just a little albuminous lump of carbon. It is more complex than all the biggest cities in the United States and the world. And we all know it. Just look at all this stuff. You ought to hear Dr. Tour talk about the lipid bilayer of one cell. That skin around that cell. That is an incredible piece of work. As is every other organelle inside that, and especially the nucleus with all of the DNA in it. Folks, so I want to talk to you about size for just a minute. You know, a meter is about that long, 1 meter. So look, a decimeter is 1/10 of that. A centimeter is 1/100. A millimeter is 1/1000. A micrometer is 1/1,000,000. A nanometer is 1 billionth. And a picometer is 1 trillionth of the length of a meter. All right, class, imagine now, take a meter and divide it up into 1 billion equal parts. And imagine how big that is. And that's the size we're working on tonight in this discussion. So I'll give you one little help. I want you to hold your finger up and look at your fingernail, if you have one. Mine is so little I can't even hardly see it. Hold your fingernail sideways. You see the width of your fingernail right there? Divide that by about 1,000, and you're getting close to the size of what we're talking about here. It's, you can't see it. It's so small. But we're dealing with it. Because we not only have magnifying glasses and optical microscopes. With optical, you can see cells that are about 10 to 100 micrometers. You can even see chromosomes. I'm going to show you some tomorrow night. You can even see bacteria. Well, that's kind of on the edge. Some bacteria are big enough you can see them with an optical, but certainly with an electron microscope you can see these things all the way down to the nanometer size, and X-ray crystallography opens up more even at the atomic size. And may I just summarize this way, class? All the way down to here, we see tremendous things that have to be... That was terrible. We see tremendous things that have to be... Exactly right. Everywhere you look, there are in every living cell thousands of little machines. We call them nanomachines. And a molecular machine is a natural device on the molecular scale, nanometers, able to convert chemical energy to produce linear or rotary motion, as well as controlling many biological functions. They're little machines that can do stuff, if I may put it in common English. And they do all kinds of stuff, or you'd be, what do you think, dead. And for each of their functions that they perform, they are... Yep. They are. And we ought to all give them their due. So I'm going to mention three. Myosin helps contraction of your muscles. Kinesin and dynein. Kinesin is a cargo carrier. You got to move something from there to there. Do we do this all the time? In a factory or in a warehouse? Of course we do. Well, if the same thing happens in the cell, it's made over here. You got to get it over here. Call on a kinesin. Dynein's do the same thing, only they usually go the opposite direction. And both of them are involved in cell division. So, I want to show you a little video tonight showing the busyness of a kinesin walker and a dynein walker in cell division. And please understand, when I get finished, I will have done a miserable job of showing you how complex and incredible those things are. But jury, I want you to get a little taste of what we're talking about here. Nature did not do this by itself. All right. Michael, are you ready back there? There's the kinesin walker in a cartoon walking on a microtubule. That's the kinesin walker right there. He's skinny as a rail, isn't he? But he is tough as nails. He can carry something about 20,000 times as heavy as he is. And he can carry it pretty fast. And here's a guy named Drew Berry who's a biomedical animator. What I'm going to show you is some stuff tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday night that this guy has animated because you can't see it. So he builds animations to show you what's happening. He's incredible. You need to go study him. So here we are. This is a microscope picture of a living cell. Go ahead, Mike. And we're going to watch it now divide, because you can actually watch this under a microscope. So here it goes, and you can see all the DNA is collecting together, and it starts to get organized, and then it starts collecting along a axis here, and then at the point that's right, it pulls apart, and watch. All of this DNA is the exact copy of that DNA, and the cell divides, and you now have two cells. Stop it right there, Mike. You now have two cells instead of one. Now, I'm going to give you a chance to guess, class. How many cells died in your body today? You want to take a guess? Roughly. I mean, if you're within thousands, I'm okay. You want to take a guess? How many do you think? 456. That's a good number. Way off. All right, what do you say? 1,000. What'd you say? Hundreds of thousands. That's much better. Class, it's between 50 and 70,000 cells per day that die in your body. That's why you better be bathing a lot and discharging stuff. Did you know that? Those cells got to be made up. They are made up because cells in your body divide. You have billions of cells that are doing this in your body every day. Billions with a B. And when the copy is made, and I wish I had time to show you Drew's picture of copying DNA. Maybe we'll do that. It's beyond belief. And it copies at an incredible rate, and it makes exact copies. No mistakes. Well, I can't quite say that, because it does make a mistake once in a while, but did you know there are little enzymes that are proteins running up and down that thing checking for mistakes? Yes, there are. Inside your body. That's why most copying is legit, because even the bad ones get corrected. All right, let's go on now, Mike. So what we're going to do now is look at this again. And this time we're going to focus in on one chromosome. So everybody stay with me here. Don't get lost. You see that chromosome right there? There's two copies of it hooked together. And this is metaphase. And so now you're going to get closer and you're going to watch. Keep going. You see this red region here? Go ahead. Stop right there. That is called the kinetic core. And these little strands coming out of both sides are microtubules. You saw it in a picture a while ago. And the microtubules are taking responsibility for helping the splitting up of those two. Okay? So my job is to show you a couple of molecular machines. This whole thing is a machine! Oh, I'm sorry. Mike, I pushed the wrong button. Can you get me over there in a hurry? Just move it. Yeah, move that thing. Thank you. Keep it going. Keep it going. Keep it going. All right. A little more. A little more. There's the kinetic core. And a little more. Okay, stop right there. These are the kinetic cores. That's the action place. And what it's doing is it's making all the preparations needed to split this thing up and pull it off in opposite directions. And these microtubules are critical to that whole process. The entire thing that's happening here is a molecular motor class. And within it, there are a bunch of motors working inside the motor. Okay, go ahead. A giant molecular machine that controls chromosome movement. You see, I said it, and it's true. So now we're going to look at this kinetic core up more close. Let's take a little close-up view here of the kinetic core. Here it is. Stop right there, Mike. All right, you see all these red things? They're not really red, class. That's for the picture. But these are a bunch of proteins. There are over two. I want you to listen closely. There are over 200 different proteins working in here, doing stuff. Part of what they're doing is building these highways that are called microtubules. They're being built right over here. At the other end of those microtubules, there's another bunch of proteins tearing them down. Does that sound like our government? So why do you build them over here and tear them down over here? Folks, if you kept all those microtubules that take place in cell division, you'd have the biggest clogged up cell in the history of mankind. You can't have it. So they have to tear them up and then they use all the parts again. Does that sound like a plan to you? No, it does to me. All right, keep going. All right, so here these proteins are really busy making the microtubules and keeping the attachments and doing all their busy work here. And there's a bunch of other stuff going on that I don't have time to talk about. Now this picture is going to show you once they get ready. See, they're not ready yet because it's still red. Once they get ready, the proteins are all going to turn. Green. They don't turn green, class. Stop right there. Green means they've reached a point in the sensitivity of that system that it's time to split up that chromosome. But do you notice there's still a few red ones? What that means, class, is those red ones have a purpose that are going to be used to help send a signal. And guess who's going to carry the signal? The dynein walker. So you watch. As this now gets ready to divide, here's what happens. Go. They're caught up in here. You're going to see them in a minute. See this little walker right here carrying one of the red guys? There's another one. And they're coming down, and notice he's got big legs. That's so he can walk around all these guys that are in the way. Go in the opposite direction. You see this guy up here? That's a Kinesian walker. Notice how he's scuttling along going the other way? Because there's stuff to do back there too. So this is going on constantly in your body every time a cell divides. All right, now here we're going to watch as they come to fruition, and now they're going to split apart. And they turn green like everything else. And there it goes. And so now we're back looking at a live cell dividing. And that, what you just saw, is what's happening inside there that takes these separate from one another with two exact copies. Okay, thanks, Mike. Let's go on to the next one. Do I do it or do you? I do it? Okay. Here's Dr. Tour I was telling you about earlier. And look, I'm going to tell you it's 8:15, but you didn't know that because you were listening so intently. I need about 10 more minutes. Don't you go anywhere. This is once in a lifetime. I don't preach this long, but I do about this. Dr. Tour is a nanoengineer at Rice, and he is an incredible human being. You need to get to know him. I love just listening to him, especially talking about this stuff. And I wish I could tell you a lot, but I just want to tell you one thing. He is working on all kinds of nano machines that can help you and me. One of his most promising studies involves the fusion of a separated spinal cord. We've developed a material where we can take it into the split spinal cord of a rodent, put one drop of material on it, and put it back together. They have taken a little rodent, cut his spinal cord, put this material in. It's called graphene ribbons. It's one carbon layer of graphene in a lattice. And they insert that into the spinal column. And what happens is the nerves of that little rat start growing around that lattice, and they grow back together. And that little rat is almost 95% good walker as he was before they cut his spinal cord. That's nanoengineering. This guy's incredible. He's got about 12 companies he's already started out of their nanoengineering at Rice University. I mean, not him personally, but he's had a part in it. And so they decided they were going to build some nano cars, kids. Nano cars. Well, what do you have to have with a car? You got to have a motor, right? You got to have scans and sensors and actuators. You got to have a suspension system, axle and bearings. You got to have wheels. You got to have fuel. They can drive these things with light or with chemicals, either one. And then you got a car that you got to put together. They have put together cars, ladies and gentlemen, that are the size of one molecule. That's a nano car. And there's one right there. There are the wheels, there are the axles, there's the driving force. Everything's there you need for a little car, and you can make it run across a gold foil. Only way you can do it is under an electron microscope, because you can't see it. But it's real. And, of course, different people in different parts of the world are kind of trying to compete. Men like to compete, right? I'm going to have a better nano car than you. So there have literally been a nano car race. This was one of the ones that Dr. Tour built. You see that little piece in the middle? That's the rotor that it spins across this foil and makes it go. Pretty incredible. So the first official nano car race was held April 28th and 29th in 2017 in Toulouse, France. Need a drum roll. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce to you the team from the University of Graz in Austria and Rice University in the U.S. I guess we, And then the team from France, Sabatier University, the team from Germany, Technical University of Dresden, team from Japan, National Institute for Material Science, Switzerland, University of Basel, and another U.S. team from Ohio University. These are all our competitors. They're at different places on Earth, and they're running over different foils, but everybody's being watched carefully so they can compete. The idea is, how fast can yours go and how much time? And I'm pleased to announce that the Austria-U.S. team won the whole thing because their little car went 150 nanometers. That's 151 billionths of this. In an hour and a half. Incredible! That's 100 nanometers per hour class. That's a lot. The nearest competitor was Switzerland. They went 103 nanometers in 6.5 hours. That's only 20 nanometers per hour, and the rest of the guys quit. I told you, tour is good. And you say, why in the world are they messing around with nano cars? Because it's fun. But I'll tell you what, it's more than that, class. We are learning about molecular machines from nature. So I want to tell you this piece. The first one they built was this one. It has this rotor here. It would rotate at 1.8 revolutions per hour. 1.8 in 1 hour. Is that slow? Well, that's not good enough. So they had to build another one. Class, please don't miss this. To build the second one, they had to start all over and go through a whole complex process. And they ended up with one change in the rotor. Do you see this rotor ever has an S in it? And it's a 6 chain. It's got 5 carbons and a sulfur. This has the sulfur taken out, and it's a 5-carbon chain. And with that one change, they went from 1.8 revolutions per hour to 3 million revolutions per second. That thing's burning the breeze. Class, the nano car that Tour built goes faster than a cheetah for its size. I say that's fun. But here are comments from Dr. Tour. You listen closely because my whole lecture's getting summed up right here. And you're on the jury. And every molecular machine is better than his. Way better. And does more stuff. And is more accurate. And more precise. And more... The nano cars built by Rice University were much smaller and far less complex than the Kinesin and Dynein walkers and other molecular machines in every living system. We worked on this for 20 years. Every molecular machine in living cells was much larger, at least 10,000 times, much more complex and much more sophisticated. Listen, that Kinesin walker can outstrip that nano car any day with what he does. Here is a taste, ladies and gentlemen, of how much work slash intelligence it took to produce this nanocar. So are you with me? Don't you miss this. Your eyes get on this screen. Everybody's eyes up here. Kids, are you looking? I'm giving you how much work it took to build that one stupid little car. It's not a stupid little car. It's amazing. This is the first page of information. That's page one of the molecular characterization of that one molecule. That's a one-molecule car. Here's page two. Were you finished reading the other, by the way? And Dr. Tour was asked when he won that race, he said, they said, are you going to publish so we can help copy what you did? He said, of course. And within 2 months, he had a paper, this is it, in Tetrahedron magazine. Notice here that it was published May 17, 2017. That's about a month after the race. No, not even that. And look over here. There are 281 more pages like those other two I just showed you. Do you get some idea of why I get so infuriated when a man like Richard Dawkins will talk about how stupid I am and Dr. Tour is? He couldn't anymore do this if he were a man on the moon. And he dares to belittle believers who do amazing things. And they do it partly because they're motivated by the God of heaven. So there's this little old car that runs around on gold foil. But listen to this. We have motorized versions that when you shine a light on them, they propel across surfaces. The motor spins at 3 million rotations per second. They've made them better. We now translated these and took off the wheels. Are you listening? And we're using them in solution to drill into cells. We're using it in a new way to do therapy. We put a little peptide on them, which is a small protein, and that will target a specific cell type, and then it goes and it binds to that cell. Then we turn them on, and the motor goes on and drills a hole in the cell and kills it in about 1 minute. And so now we're targeting things like pre-melanoma and seeing if we can use it to target specific cancer cells and kill them rapidly. So we're moving into the medical scenario. We got somebody fighting cancer right here. Folks, if we could ever begin to start to think about beginning to do 1/10 millionth of what one molecular machine does inside a cell, we could change amazing things. And what we do when we study that as Christians is we think, isn't it incredible what God has done? Not, look how nature did this. Isn't it amazing what Mother Nature did? If you have that much faith, beloved, I don't want you on my jury. So I say this is a reliable and reasonable conclusion. We know that nanocars were designed by intelligent human engineers. Nobody's denying that. So what about living cells with all their thousands of nanomachines, which are far more intricate, complex, interdependent, and full of digital information? Surely those were designed by somebody. I call that somebody God, and he's far beyond anything any paltry human being will ever dream of. There is nothing unreasonable about that conclusion, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. And I hope you're there because we haven't touched the hem of the garment to give honor to what God has done. No wonder Anthony Flew, atheist, debater, and author, wrote a book called There Is a God. In which he said the subtitle is How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. He spent 80 years of his life as an atheist and debating creationists and belittling our positions. Now, he says in an interview, it has become inordinately difficult even to begin to think about constructing a naturalistic theory of the evolution of that first reproducing organism. The enormous complexity by which the results were achieved looks to me like the work of intelligence. Well, thank you. I appreciate that an 80-year-old man would change his mind about something as significant as that. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And I say, amen. So can Christianity and science coincide, class? The Bible teaches us that the things which are made cause us to see God, even His invisible attributes. Science shows us that everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they're made. Everywhere we see a grand evidence of design, and you have to really work at it to get around it. So is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? No, you're a fool, says Dawkins. You believe in a deluded psychotic. No, sir, I pity your position when you stand before God one day and He asks you, with the unfolding of all the evidence I put before you, how dare you stand in my presence? Christianity and science agree, you see. It is more reasonable than ever to believe in God. And that's my lesson. Thank you for your attention.